The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
Medical case manager for the South region of the country met with all of the case managers. He was a medical doctor and said, whatever kids are static, I want you to throw them out of case management programs, so we're not going to provide any of these special coverages to them anymore. And in one day, over 100 catastrophically ill or injured children were thrown out of the program.
Ted Leopold talks about what he calls the perfect textbook case of corporate greed and his own challenging childhood affliction.
I think I learned early on that because of the deficiencies I had in some areas, you have to work around and use the assets that all do work well to try and get you to your goal and to what you want to try and accomplish.
And his very realistic approach to trial law.
We lose a lot because these cases are very hard. And you're up against the largest companies in the world, usually up against some of the best law firms and attorneys, and they just don't roll over. It's not your typical intersection collision type of case.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. It was helping a friend of a friend in a practice area outside of his usual cases that led Ted Leopold to find and win a new kind of case, one that would change his career. It was the first managed care case of its kind in the country and would lead to a flood of others. Most recently, he's expanded into a novel way to try workers' compensation cases outside of workers' compensation courts. Also, the discovery that he personally took from the engineers in the Takata airbag case has been used by plaintiffs in cases across the country. It was that same discovery that unearthed doctored documents in what's become groundbreaking litigation. Ted Leopold sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in June 2020 to talk about the lessons he's learned from law practice and life, including how he's persevered through a childhood disability that he talks about for the first time.
Ted, in your 33 years of practicing trial law so far, you've handled complex tort litigation, the biggest of the big, some of the most complex ever. But there's one that you like to point out as, quote, the perfect textbook case of corporate greed, unquote, and it involved a little 7-year-old girl. Can you tell us about that case?
Sure, Harvey. I think the case, at least in my experience in practicing for over 30 years now, is a case that I litigated back in the middle 90s called Chips versus Humana. And that was a case where a little girl was denied speech occupational physical therapy. She was born with cerebral palsy. And as a result, her father, who worked with the sheriff's office, had wonderful coverage with a particular carrier. But since the sheriff's office is so big, they would sort of put out for bid each year coverage companies to come in, managed care companies. And Humana bidded on the product and got the coverage. And the father could stay on the previous policy, but wanted to make sure that if he went with Humana, would his daughter still be sure to get physical, speech, and occupational therapy? Because those of us who've handled these kind of cases know that for a little child with cerebral palsy, one of the most important aspects of her care and treatment is constant therapies, both physical, occupational, and speech. And the Humana representative said, absolutely. In fact, we're going to do one thing even better for you. We're going to put her into our medical case management program so that she doesn't need to go to a primary physician just to be given the okay to go to a specialist for her speech therapy. And sure enough, they did. And for 2 years, everything was fine. And then one day, her dad, out of nowhere, got an unsigned letter from Humana saying, "Your daughter has improved to such an extent, she no longer needed to be in speech, occupational, physical therapy, or our case management program." And father wasn't sure what that meant, because he prayed every day that his daughter would become healthy, but she was never going to not have cerebral palsy. And he knew at this young age she needed those therapies. So when he went to the on-site representative at the sheriff's office and talked to the Humana representative, the representative said, "Gee, I don't know what this is. I haven't seen this before." So he called Louisville, Kentucky, where Humana was corporate offices were located, came back a little chagrined and said, "Yeah, she's no longer going to get speech, occupation, physical therapy, and she's no longer in the case management program." And from that point on, his little girl was not going to get those therapies. And that's when he came to see me. And that was in December of 1994. And for 5 years, we litigated that case with over 300 motions to compel to try and get documents from Humana. And sort of the rest of the story is history from what happened from there.
And what did you discover ended up being behind that whole thing?
What we discovered after 5 years of litigation and a lot of motions and getting documents and taking depositions is that in around 1992, 1993 timeframe, Humana wanted to save over $80 million in the southeast region of the country. And they tried to figure it out. They really couldn't do it. So they went to Coopers & Lybrand. And Coopers & Lybrand came up with a business model for them. And the business model was, whatever case managers are focusing on children who are static, in other words, aren't constantly running into the hospital all the time, we should get rid of those, or Humana, you should get rid of those kids so that the case managers can focus on the more chronically ill and keep them out of hospitals, because, of course, hospitalization is the most costly to a managed care company. So on one day, and there's a sort of a long story behind that, but on one day we learned the following, that the medical case manager for the South region of the country met with all of the case managers. He was a medical doctor, and said, "Whatever kids are static, I want you to throw them out of case management programs, so we're not going to provide any of these special coverages to them anymore." And in one day, over 100 catastrophically ill or injured children were thrown out of the program. And even though a kid, for example, was blind, spastic, quadriplegic, and had cerebral palsy and over 50 to 100 seizures a day, he was considered static, and he got the same letter as Caitlin's father did. In fact, it got so bad that they sent an unsigned letter to a young man who was about 16 years old, signed and delivered to him in an envelope with his name on it. Only problem is he's been in a coma for the last 8 years, but he was deemed to be static and not chronically ill. So it was over 100 children like that that they did that to. And at the end of the litigation and at trial, all this came out, and there was a very rational reason why the jury ended up awarding about $78 million in punitive damages, because that was the approximate amount that Humana was intending on saving by instituting this program.
Wow, that's huge. As a matter of fact, the Public Justice Foundation recognized you and that case for being groundbreaking litigation involving the managed care industry. That was a real trendsetter case, wasn't it?
It was. At that time, you know, people have to remember managed care was still young at that point. You know, we're talking about managed care really getting started in the late 80s and into the 90s. And Humana actually started by three guys who started a nursing home, and it grew into this hugely successful managed care company. And by the mid 90s, they had already grown to around the country. And this particular case was really the first managed care case of its kind that was litigated not on a contract issue where somebody, a managed care company, didn't pay for charges that were performed. It was the first of its kind where there was a litigation for a really a tort for the failure to provide coverage or care. And as a result of the failure to do that, the individual here, Caitlin Chipps, cerebral palsy child, was unable to get the physical occupational speech therapy that she needed. And as a result, she was harmed in a personal injury way. And these cases sort of reverberated. Managed care companies really took note of it. You know, for at least a while, they decided to change their internal policies and procedures, not just Humana, but other companies. But, you know, as time went on, they sort of relaxed again, and people who needed medically necessary care for cancer treatment or other types of treatment weren't able to get it. And we've been successful in bringing a full measure of justice for those families who either lost loved ones as a result of that unyielding denial of care, or people who survive but receive very serious personal injuries.
That's terrific. Was the Chipps case a springboard case for you and your trial practice?
It was to a certain extent. Prior to that, I had always been working on primarily product liability, automotive crashworthiness litigation. Certainly the Chipps case was a little bit outside of my bandwidth in terms of the type of cases that I was doing at the time. But after the Chipps case, of course, a flood of these types of litigations, which I still continue to do to this day, we've expanded the managed care litigation to even doing it in workers' compensation matters, where workers' compensation carriers, which oftentimes can really do some horrific denial of care and coverage issues to the workers who have been injured on the job. And as a result, we've been very successful in the workers' comp area as well to take these same concepts and litigate them, not in the comp court, but we can sue in circuit court in tort, which is sort of a novelty. And not many people really do those kind of cases. So it's been very important type of work. It's been successful for us. But again, most important, it's been helpful to the clients.
Sure. Now, you graduated from Coral Gables High School. You got your undergraduate degree from the University of Miami. And then you went back to high school.
I did. I graduated from Coral Gables High in 1976. And now, although I'm in my early 60s, I feel the effects of playing too much football growing up. I knew then, at least at that time, what I really wanted to do. I had had scholarship offers to play football in college, but really, because of my size, which is for college purposes, was small and certainly had no future in after college playing pro ball. So I really wanted to get into coaching. And I have a degree in history with a minor in education. Coral Gables High won many, many national championships, state championships, and some of the very important, great athletes came out of Coral Gables High in football in the 60s that went on to become very accomplished professional football players. So I did that. I went back to high school and coached, and I was had been recently married for about a year. We got married in 1983. And I decided that I was either going to go on as a graduate assistant in college and make coaching a true career, or law school, and decided to go the law school route. And I will never forget the words of my wife. First thing she says, wasn't wonderful or great about going to law school? She said, if I put you through law school and then you divorce me, I'll kill you. Now she, after 37 years of marriage, she sort of changed her tune. She says, I'm not going to kill you. I'm just going to just take all the money we have and see you later. So,
goodness.
But it's been a beautiful 37 years. And, but for my wife, I'm not sure I would have had much, if any, success.
Oh, congratulations to you. And behind every good, successful man, they often say, as the old expression goes, there's a good woman behind him.
Very true.
And I'm sure when the roles are reversed, that is also the case, the man who backs the woman. Ted, you faced a particularly daunting obstacle growing up.
Well, I guess it's always interesting, not something that I've really have talked much about, if at all, really. But when I was very young, first, second grade or so, I was diagnosed actually not with dyslexia, because back in 1963, 64, 65, dyslexia wasn't really known. You know, a lot of doctors we went to see when I was little, my mom would take me, or in those days we went to University of Miami where they had some reading clinics, and it was more considered a mental related issue because, again, dyslexia was not even formally known at that point in time. But I had a very, very difficult time reading, I guess would probably be the best way to say it, and of connecting various issues. So that was very difficult to deal with in a multitude of ways, school and otherwise. And I've always, throughout my younger life and college and professional life, have always struggled through it in some way, shape, or form to try and find ways around the issue.
What lesson did that teach you?
I think the biggest lesson is to persevere, is to never give up, always have a goal to strive for. And I think I learned early on that because of the deficiencies I had in some areas, you have to work around and use the assets that all do work well to try and get you to your goal and to what you want to try and accomplish. You may not get there the normal way. In a straight line, you may have to zigzag a little bit, but if you're pressed to get there and you're headstrong, you'll figure out a way to do it. And I think it's always helped me very much in litigation, because litigation's not a straight road. In litigation, there's a lot of ups and downs, whether it's court-related, judge-related, defense-related, factual-related. And you have to maneuver and find the ways that will best help you in your case to get to the ultimate goal of working hard for your client and hopefully providing a full measure of justice for them.
I'm sure it also provides a great degree of empathy that you have for some of your clients as well.
I think that's a great way to put it. I think that is very, very true. Very true in many ways.
So you went to law school. You went to Samford University's Cumberland School of Law, graduated 1987. But you started your career, though, working for a defense law firm. What made you flip sides?
Well, when I got out of school, I had a friend who was working at that firm. And I knew I wanted to get into litigation. And I had always been told by a couple of people that one of the best ways to learn to become a good litigator is to start on the defense side, which for me, and I would say this today to any young person coming out of school, that's true. I think defense firms provide you a lot of structure. They provide a lot of ability to get experience quicker than perhaps on the plaintiff side or at large firms. And that happened for me. And one of the benefits that I had, at least for, I see it as a benefit, is from pretty much day one, all of the work that I had was always on very complex type of litigation. So it was very detailed. It was very serious types of cases, catastrophic type of injuries, very complex engineering related issues. So I think it helped me hone my skills very early on as a young attorney, the importance of being careful, being able to make sure you cross all your T's, dot your I's, and learning from some really, really talented attorneys on both sides, both the plaintiff and defense side. And I also had the wonderful benefit of being sort of taken under the wing of a senior partner at the firm I started off on the defense, who to this day I'm very dear friends with still, and who taught me a great deal about the right way to handle cases ethically and professionally.
So he was a mentor for you for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you got a lot of experience with that firm in defending the automobile industry, and that skill would come in very handy in a later case, another big case in your career that you took on as a plaintiff attorney, right?
That's true. Many, many years later, I switched over from the defense side to the plaintiff side around 1990, 91, somewhere around there, and moved out of Miami up to Palm Beach. And I guess around 10 years ago now, 8 years ago, handled a very interesting case, dealt with the stability and handling of a Ford Explorer and the issues of a restraint belt. And that case was Cole versus Ford, where a Major League Baseball player for the New York Mets was involved in a rollover accident, wearing his seatbelt, belt spooled out during the rollover, and he was ejected. And that case was tried actually twice in Mississippi, in Laurel, Mississippi.
That was one of the record-setting ones, right? $131 million?
It was a very interesting case because, of course, dealing with a lot of different things. Of course, being in Mississippi, we had an African-American client who had lost his life, extremely talented. And what made the case, I guess, so valuable in terms of a verdict amount was he was a remarkable baseball player. He was of the type of Albert Pujols and Torrey Hunter. He played with those guys. He played in the Arizona League, which was a sort of an all-star minor league team. His stats were as good as Albert Pujols and Torrey Hunter and others. So he was really the cream of the crop in terms of what his future potential was. And it was a fascinating case because we had the former manager of the New York Mets testified, the scouting team members testified about his capabilities, how baseball scouts people, how they rank them, what his potential would have been. And here, of course, the economics in that case was huge because if you put him on par with a Torrey Hunter or Albert Pujols, you can imagine what his future lost wages were. So we were able to put quite a large number on the board for the jury, and the award was a compensatory amount, and the jury also found that punitive damages were warranted, and the court, right after the verdict, said, okay, we'll take a break for 30 minutes and come back and argue punitive damages, and within that 30 minutes, the case had settled. Ford did not want to go to a punitive damage argument.
Sure, the writing was on the wall, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it was a very interesting case for a multitude of reasons.
Well, and you've been part of that huge ongoing Takata airbag series of cases too, right?
In terms of some groundbreaking type of litigation, I actually litigated the case called Mincy versus Takata, which was a state court case up in Jacksonville. And when the Takata matter first broke, there was, of course, many class actions filed. Actually, they were venued by the MDL panel in Southern District in front of Judge Marino down in South Florida. But in addition, there were well over 100, if not more, individual personal injury suits and deaths as a result of the explosion of the canisters of the Takata airbags in a variety of different vehicles. But the cases really didn't go anywhere, and the MDL was primarily a financial economic injury type of case for the loss of value of vehicles. But in order to prevail in those cases, really, you had to get to the core issue of the defect. And in the Mincy case, I was the first one, I may be mistaken, but to this day may be really the only one that had actually taken all of the discovery of all of the engineers, including going over to Japan and take those depositions. From what I understand, a lot of the discovery I developed in that case has been used in the other cases and the MDL. But what we learned was, and I was got a copy of it, which is fascinating in many ways, and was a major exhibit, of course, in the case, was the Takata engineers in the U.S. who was developing for Japan Takata the airbag modules and canisters showed during the development that they failed, they would explode. And when the engineering information got to Japan, the Japanese engineers for Takata altered the test data. And wherever it showed that they failed, they would write and literally alter the numbers of pressurizations and showed that they passed. and they would take those documents and then show it to the OEM manufacturers like Honda, General Motors, Ford, and say, look, our test, the development is fine. They all passed and they're all ready to go. And they put them in the cars that way.
Oh my goodness.
I was able to get the original failed test document and then the altered document that the Japanese engineers had doctored up and put, you can put them side to side and you could see it. It was quite a wonderful exhibit, if you can imagine.
How were you able to get that?
Through a whistleblower who had kept the original document showing the failures. He kept it because he was asked by Takata US to look into the issue. And when he did, he made a whole report showing what had happened and how the Japanese engineers at Takata altered the documents. And he made a large report. And I got a copy of that report.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Ted, many attorneys aspire to serve the public interest beyond their immediate client through socially significant litigation. But man, you've managed to do it. I mean, the Chips case, the Cole case, the Takata case. How?
Well, that's a good question. How? I think you have to always keep your eyes open. Think outside the box. I know I've taken cases on that a lot of people would have turned down and did turn down in some cases, that were important cases to do and to litigate and bring knowledge about that to the community and to help a particular family. Not all of them were successful, but some were, and some we broke new ground on that happened. And, you know, I mean, the Takata case is a little bit of an example of that. You just got to be creative, I guess.
Well, and that Chips case was a pro bono case, was it not? Initially?
It was. My best friend of, we're raised together in Coral Gables, who lives up in the Palm Beach area. He said he had a friend who worked at the sheriff's office was having a problem with his daughter and wanted to know if I could talk to him to give him some advice. And he did. He came over. Mark Chips was his name. And he came over, met him at the office, talked to him. And then as we were talking, just decided I'd try to do whatever I could to help him. And one thing led to another and ended up filing a lawsuit. And 5 years later was the rest of the story.
So it sounds like part of the success is relationships with people, developing them. And
I think that's true. I think being involved in the community is very important. In some charitable aspects of the community is helpful, legal aspect, bar association or something else, legal aid, whatever it may be. Being out of the community is helpful, and also getting the experience, trying cases, writing where you can, getting things published are helpful. All of that, I think, gives you the foundation and the stability to be known within a community, both local, statewide, and if you're fortunate enough, national, if that's what you want to do, to get cases and to be called on various cases. You know, the Flint case that I'm co-lead on now is a good example of that. People know about you. You know, something terrible happens, they think a lot of you, respect you, know that you could do a good job, and ask you to get involved in certain things. So a lot of it's word of mouth and also results.
Now, at one point you started your own law firm. Do you have some keys to how to build a practice that you can share?
Yeah, so I was with the same partner for a long time, around 20 years, maybe, give or take, here in Palm Beach. And got to a point where I decided just to dissolve that firm and go on my own with some people that I was already working with. I think finding, which is not always easy, but finding really good quality people to work with. And when I use that, I mean both professionally and personally, who have the same ideals, thoughts, concepts as you have about treating others the way you yourself would want to be treated, whether it's the woman or man that's cleaning the office at night, or the judge that's sitting on the bench, or a client. I think all of those types of things are very important, and they sort of build upon each other. You know, the same work ethics of working hard, being willing to work hard is important. And in this, you know, the law practice, and especially litigation, is not as some of us know, is not easy. It takes a lot of time, a lot of sometimes travel, a lot of understanding of your spouse and family, a lot of time away from home sometimes. And I think you have to really care about what you're doing to sometimes put that ahead of some other things.
How do you handle disappointment? I mean, not every case ends up being a winner, despite your great record and our other Titans. Losing is part of the game, isn't it? And how do you handle that?
Losing is a part of the game, and anyone who says it doesn't happen is not being truthful. And if they say it doesn't happen a lot, they're not being truthful, because we lose a lot. Because these cases are very hard, and you're up against usually the largest companies in the world, usually up against some of the best law firms and attorneys, and they just don't roll over. It's not your typical intersection collision type of case. So losing can be difficult. Of course, you feel terrible for the clients, most importantly, and it's not great for your ego. Which, a lot of trial lawyers have huge egos. I think it goes without saying, all of us in some way, shape or form have egos. I'd like to think I don't have a big ego, but maybe others would say differently, but it's hard. It can be hard in a couple of ways, that it's deflating and that you can second guess yourself about your own ability sometimes. And when you have, just speaking for myself, sort of goes back to the earlier question, which it's hard to appreciate if you have not gone through it, whether it's dyslexia or some other, I think I could use the word handicap in some way. When you're young and growing up, if you do have some sort of handicap that has caused some emotional issues of overcoming certain things or being made fun of or whatever, it can certainly bring those types of thoughts back into your mind again. So it can be difficult. And I think you have to work very hard to keep an upbeat attitude about it.
As we sit here and chat in the spring of 2020, you've been a practicing attorney for 33 years now. Along the way, you've been honored with many awards: Top Florida Lawyer, Super Lawyers List, Best Lawyers in America. You're a past president of the Public Justice Foundation. You've also served on the board of the Florida Justice Association, and in fact, you're a recipient of the FJA's Eagle Centurion Award, which recognizes those who've contributed $250,000 to the Eagle Endowment, which itself is a reflection of public justice advocacy. Ted, how has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
Well, I think the organization in so many ways speaks for itself. It's an organization that not only educates attorneys, both young and old, in trial skills, and also brings about camaraderie that you don't get a lot of places. But most importantly is what the association does in Tallahassee in terms of protecting consumer rights. The organization has been the leader for so many years in making sure that the rights of individuals and consumers and those less fortunate than ourselves are protected. And they do a wonderful job of lobbying, of making sure bills can hopefully get stopped that are not helpful to at least in my view, the community, to society in general. And they are able to promote issues to the various legislators that are important, to make them aware. Even if the legislators don't agree with them, at least we're there to talk, to raise issues, and to filter through all the nonsense that we hear now on social media, et cetera. So they're really the final backstop, if you will, of making sure that rights and justice can always prevail.
How important is it to give back to the FJA and especially the foundation that focuses on research and education, some of those topics specifically that you just mentioned?
Mm-hmm. I think it's, axiomatic that we have to do that as attorneys. I think that's one of our obligations. We have to be involved. And that is involved. Involvement means, at the local level, and at the state level and even at the national level. But, you know, make sure getting involved in your own trial lawyer section in your community. Make sure that you go up to Tallahassee once or twice if you can during sessions and lobbying, even getting involved in the board committees or running for office, and providing funds. I mean, we have to do that. We do it to our churches or to our temples and to our communities. This is no different. We have to make sure that they can be funded to do what they need to do in order to protect our clients and our community and society as a group. There's no substitute for it.
Now, you've mentioned earlier what a challenging career law can be, especially with the complex, very time-consuming cases that you practice. Ted, how do you balance your professional life with your family life?
Well, it hasn't always been easy. Again, I've been married 37 years, have a tremendously understanding wife. We have three children who are now older and late 20s and early 30s. But a lot of this was hard when they were young. And by that, I mean, you know, when you have young clients, children who either parents lost them or seriously injured and you come home to your own children at night, those were always very difficult times. And probably the reason why I did not always like to talk about work when I came home. And the kids always seemed to understand. My wife always seemed to understand. Then also having the ability to get away from work, which is not always easy. Hobbies is great. Some say I'm still trying to find a hobby. my golden retriever seems to have been, we're on our fourth golden retriever. So she's always been our hobby in some way. But, you know, I like to exercise every day, either go to the gym or run or do something. Because I think being physically healthy and emotionally healthy as best we can is important.
What one piece of advice would you have for incoming lawyers today?
The biggest piece of advice is to care very deeply about what you do. Be honest with yourself that this is something that you really want to do and you're doing it for the right reasons. And finding somebody that can mentor you, who is someone who is worthy to be a mentor, who has good morals and can teach you about life, professional and otherwise.
Ted, how would you like to be remembered?
Someone that worked that did really, really good work and was very professional and a nice guy.
Ted Leopold, you are a titan of trial. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.